Max Weber, or Max Weber as most people call him, is a sociologist, actually, was. He wrote this book in 1919, right after the First World War, and really is a speech that he gave. Technological triumph of the week. It just happens quite by coincidence that during the time that I was... Oh, I hate these things. During the time that I was doing my own graduate study in law school, after I had been teaching in law school for a few years, and had gone back to study further with two men, one by the name of Max Reinstein, and the other one by the name of Carl Nickerson Llewellyn. Both of these gentlemen are very well known, both dead now. They're excellent scholars in their own field, both Germans by birth, really. They were both then involved, and that was 1952, in translating stuff written by Max Weber. And I cut my teeth, really, on Weber at that point. His best-known work is one called The Protestant Ethic, in which he develops how much distortion we have had in the Protestant ethic and what it's done to our sense of economics, especially insofar as we saw predestination as being part of our Christianity, and read further from the idea of predestination into the idea that God blessed his own people, and that this was evidenced by more productive cattle and more productive farms and bigger barns. And God blessed his people, you see, and you could always recognize the elect and the true Son of God by how prosperous he was. Weber says this had tremendous influence in our culture. The United States developed a whole concept of hard work and thrift and industry out of this, and economically it was very helpful. And spiritually is another problem. You've already seen something pretty significant about Max Weber, and that is that he is essentially a dualist. He is quite able to divide man's life into working here for corn or salary, and another problem over there, which is a religious problem. He arrives at a masterpiece of that sort of thing in this pamphlet, or this speech. Since all of you have not had a chance to read it, I'd like to read a couple short portions of the book for you, and then we can talk about it for a little while. On page 43, for those of you who have a copy of this material, he gets down to what he entitles in the subheading, Ethics and Politics. And he's now going to tell us something about the ethical problem. And it is interesting, as you follow Weber now, that he sees ethics as being a problem of morality, and morality as being essentially a problem of religion. And I would like to suggest to you that this is where the specious analysis begins, because as Weber is using the words, ethics and morality have nothing at all to do with Christianity. Watch him as he works. He says, but first let us free ourselves from the quite trivial falsification, namely that ethics must first appear in a morally highly compromised role. And what he's talking about is, in order to be a good politician, that you must necessarily have this highly compromised moral position, or else you simply can't operate. On page 44 at the bottom, he says, "Now then, what relation do ethics and politics actually have? Have the two nothing whatever to do with one another, as has occasionally been said? That is, you either have a spiritual problem or you have a political problem. You can't have both, they're unrelated to each other. Or is a politician a man who must also have some spiritual concerns? Is the reverse true, that the ethic of a political conduct is identical with that of any other conduct? Occasionally, an exclusive choice has been believed to exist between the two propositions. That is, you can't have both. You're going to have one or the other. Either the one or the other proposition must be correct. But it is true that any ethic of the world could establish commandments," he says, "commandments, orders, laws, rules. But any ethic of the world could establish commandments." And in case you aren't sensitive this evening, is Ed still awake, Vic? Thank you. My brother Ed Autumn, not my brother, he's my friend from Seattle. He has a tendency to go to sleep anytime anyone talks more than 5 minutes. I'm approaching that, and this is one lecture he's going to stay awake for. You notice that Weber here has used in this one phrase the words that any ethic could establish commandments. Now you've got your tip off where this guy is going from writing that one phrase, because he sees the ethical problem, which he is trying to make us believe is a spiritual problem, as being one which is developing rules, laws. And so he immediately is confusing, if I can put it that way, the idea of an ethical problem, by which he means a spiritual problem, with a legal problem. Now, having just stepped down the first step in the stairway, which he mistakenly thought was a stairway, and it turns out to be an elevator shaft, he's on his way. From here on out, there's nothing you can do for Max Weber. He simply has missed the entire boat. But since he's going to go down the shaft anyway, let's watch him as he goes. "Any ethic of the world could establish commandments of identical content for erotic or business or familial or official relations, for the relations of one's wife to the greengrocer, the son, the competitor, the friend, the defendant. Should it really matter so little for the ethical demands on politics that politics operates with very special means, namely power backed up by violence?" And he says, if you really have an ethical problem here, should you really be quite so unconcerned by the fact that in politics you have to use power? And power is always, in the last analysis, only as effective as the muscle that you've got behind it. If people don't obey, you move in with the nightsticks. And he says, you can hardly be dispassionate as a politician if you have any scruples at all, just by saying, well, all right, we're going to do it, and we're going to make the rules, and if they don't like it, we'll smash them. He says, you've got to give this some consideration. "Do you not see that the Bolshevik and the Spartacist ideologists bring about exactly the same results as any militaristic dictator just because they use this power means? In what but the person of the power holders and their dilettantism does the rule of the workers' and soldiers' council differ from the rule of the power holder of the old regime? In what way does the polemic, the striking argument, you see, of most representatives of the presumably new ethic differ from that of the opponents which they criticized, or the ethic of any other of the demagogues? In their noble intention, people will say, good, but it is the means about which we speak here, and the adversaries, in complete subjective sincerity, claim in the very same way that their ultimate intentions are of lofty character. And he's saying, now you've got the guys on both sides of the fence, both claiming to have the very best intentions in the world. He says, what's the difference? One guy says, I sincerely believe that it's black, and the other one says, I sincerely believe that it's white. And how do you differentiate from these things? Then he quotes, all they that take the sword shall perish with the sword, and fighting is everywhere fighting. Hence the ethic of the Sermon on the Mount. See? And he's halfway down the shaft, full flap. But the Sermon on the Mount, by the Sermon on the Mount, we mean the absolute ethic of the gospel, which is a more serious matter than those who are fond of quoting those commandments today believe. This ethic is no joking matter. The same holds for this ethic as has been said of the causality in science. It's not a cab which one can have stopped at one's pleasure. It's all or nothing. He says you either are an ethical person or you're not an ethical person. You can't split that down the middle. And if you believe in the Sermon on the Mount, no violence, turning the other cheek and so forth, and if the man who uses the sword is going to die by the sword, and if you know that you're a politician involved in power which is going to be backed up by violence, you're into the thing so deep that you can't stop. You just can't take part of that. You either are an ethical person or you aren't an ethical person. See where he's going? This is precisely the meaning of the gospel, he says, if trivialities are not to result. Hence, for instance, it was said of the wealthy young man, he went away sorrowful, for he had great possessions. The gospel commandment, however, is unconditional and unambiguous. Give what thou hast, absolutely everything. The politician will say that this is socially senseless, a socially senseless imposition as long as it's not carried out everywhere. Thus, the politician upholds taxation, confiscatory taxation, outright confiscation. In a word, compulsion and regulation for all. The ethical commandment, however, and I pause once more to be sure that you are shuddering in horror when he says ethical commandments. He's saying law, only he doesn't think so. He thinks he's saying the spiritual, non-coercive commandment, which is coercive and uses power. He's saying the spiritual, i.e. ethical, non-coercive commandment, which is an exercise in coercion. We're three-quarters of the way down the shaft. The splash comes soon. The ethical commandment, however, is not at all concerned about that, and this unconcern is its essence. Is Ed awake? Or take the example, says Weber, turn the other cheek. Quotation, turn the other cheek. This command is unconditional. It does not question the source of the other's authority to strike. It's unconditional, you see. No ifs, ands, and buts. Just turn the other cheek. Except for a saint, it's an ethic of indignity. Yes, it is. This is it. One must be saintly in everything, at least in intention. One must live like Jesus, the apostles, Saint Francis, and their like. Then this ethic makes sense and expresses a kind of dignity, otherwise it does not. For it is said in line with a cosmic ethic of love, quote, resist not him that is evil with force, close quote. For the politician, the reverse proposition holds, thou shalt resist evil by force. Now he's marching you up to where you're going to have to make a choice. You either are going to have to be an ethical person and be completely fat-headed, or you're going to have to be a practical politician and be completely unethical. After all, the ethic of the gospel does not wish to teach that civil war is the only legitimate war. The pacifist who follows the gospel will refuse to bear arms or will throw them down. In Germany, and you remember he's a German writing in 1919, right after the First World War. In Germany, this was the recommended ethical duty to end the war, and therewith all wars. That is, everybody be a pacifist and will never have to fight again. The politician would say that the only sure means to discredit the war for all foreseeable time would have been a status quo peace. Then the nations would have questioned, well, what was this war for? And then the war would have been argued ad absurdum, which is now impossible. For the victors, at least, for at least part of them, the war will have been politically profitable. See, somebody made some dough on this, politically speaking. It did pay off. And the responsibility for this rests on behavior that made all resistance impossible for us. Now, as a result of the ethics of absolutism, that is 100% ethical, the ethics of absolutism, when the period of exhaustion will have passed, the peace will have been discredited, not the war. Finally, let's consider the duty of truthfulness. For the absolute duty, it holds untruth unconditionally. You can't lie ethically. Not even a politician can lie ethically. He's got to always tell the truth absolutely and unconditionally. Hence, the conclusion was reached to publish all documents, especially those placing the blame on one's own country and so forth. And he says this is nonsense. From this point on, and I'll not read the rest of it to you, Weber divides his argument into two parts. One he calls the ethic of ultimate ends, and the other one is the ethic of responsibility. And he says the ethic of ultimate ends is the guy who says that, the maxim of an ethic of ultimate ends, that is, in religious terms, the Christian does rightly and leaves the results with the Lord. You just do what is the right thing, what you know to be the ethical, the Christian thing, and leave the consequences to the Lord. He'll take care of it. He'll see that you get along fine. The other man, the one who holds the ethic of responsibility, says that he feels some responsibility for the way that this comes out because he, after all, is the acting party here. He is the politician. And so he's going to have to shade things a little bit. He's going to have to tell a few lies. He's going to have to do a little cheating along the line. He's going to have to behave in a way which is not absolutely, positively ethical. Now, what do we do with this as a matter of living in a social world, a political world, one which we have to act from time to time? Is there a place where we can say that a politician is acting ethically, using the sense now of religiously, that he is a Christian, specifically Christian actor, at the same time that he is a politician? Well, I start out with the proposition that there is no such thing as a Lutheran politician, or a Christian politician, or a Presbyterian politician. There are politicians who happen to be Lutheran, or Christian, or Presbyterians, and there is a big difference. A politician is, in many ways, the same thing as a doctor, or a carpenter, or anybody else. He is a man who is skilled in certain types of skills, certain types of behavior. He is a man who knows how to accomplish certain things. He has some techniques, some abilities. His occupation is an occupation of, it's an enterprise, really, of trying to bring human beings together to live in an orderly fashion. by having enacted for them certain rules and certain regulations, certain things that they have to do and certain things that they do not do. Now, in doing this, he is exercising his head, primarily. He is measuring how well this will work. He is asking the question of, if I set up this kind of a legal structure, of a political structure, will it serve the needs that I'm trying to get at? And here, will you please notice that he draws quite a sharp distinction between the techniques that he's going to follow, that is, the rules that he's going to use, whether or not you drive 70 miles an hour or only 30 miles an hour, this is what he's going to order, and what it is that he's trying to accomplish. His objective, the peace or the safety or the order, or whatever else his objective might happen to be, is not involved in this thing except the goal that he wants to attain. What he's working with now is a question of how well will this work. The politician all too frequently is apt to confuse these two things and get himself into exactly the same box that Max Weber does, and so come out with the same sort of nonsensical, in my opinion, nonsensical conclusion that Weber does. And that is that a man cannot be at one time a Christian and an effective politician. That is, he's got to fudge. He's got to do unchristian things. I don't think that this is so, but it is very easy to confuse them. About 2 years ago, maybe it was three, the American Lutheran Church cooperated with some other bodies, almost everybody else in sight, back in Brookings, South Dakota, to have what was known as a Faith in Life mission back there. I happen to have been one of the people who was back for that time. And one of the assignments they gave me was to go talk to the Chamber of Commerce. Now, the Chamber of Commerce was delighted to have a speaker, especially when he was free. But they were really not very enthusiastic about my subject, which was the effectiveness of Christianity or of Christians in the life of Brookings, how it operated. And they decided, whether they decided consciously or whether they decided just subconsciously, the way people sometimes do, to give me the business. This means that, as everybody knows, it's either a Lion or a Rotarian or anything else, that when the clock hits 1:30, it's like the witching hour for Cinderella. Everybody turns into a mouse and goes home. And the speaker of the day gets what's left between dessert and the last announcement in 1:30. That's not an expandable portion of time. That's very hard for me to live with. So what they did with me was to discuss all kinds of other things a long, long time, thinking that surely that they could hold down this, they had to listen to me because I was in town, but they didn't have to listen very long. Get as close to 1:30 as possible. So they talked about a number of things. They talked about improving the city. They talked about what a grand fair they were going to have. They talked about how they were going to get money from the parking meters to use to accomplish some of the objectives for the Chamber of Commerce. They talked about how they were going to evade the wage and hour law of their state. They talked about how they were going to employ children who were under the age that I knew was the minimum law at which children could be employed in their town, and they just talked about all sorts of lovely things. I had been introduced to a couple of the people at the head table. Now, because I was a lawyer, they decided it would be nice to make me feel comfortable, and they had sitting on one hand of me, eminent counsel, and the other hand, the prosecuting attorney. When it finally came my time to speak, I noted, first of all, that our time was brief, since I didn't want to hold them past 1:30, and that what I had wanted to say originally somehow or other now seemed inappropriate. Rather, that I wanted to observe a couple things and remark that I had counted, while they were discussing their business for the day, 7 distinct violations of the law of South Dakota, in which they had already been involved or were now conspiring to become involved. And then I turned to counsel, the attorney on my right, and said, "Counsel, am I wrong on my statutes of South Dakota, since I've never read your code, but I assume that this is the way it would be?"
And he looked up and grinned that silly grin, you know, and said, "No, that's right. That's the law here, all right." And then I turned to the prosecuting attorney, who was conveniently seated on my left, and I said to him, "You are the prosecuting attorney in this county. I assume that you are going to indict these people." And he looked up at me and gave me the good old Lions Club smile, you know, like, "Don't be an ass, friends, after all." And I said, "Well, I see that the prosecuting attorney in this county is really not interested in prosecuting those people who violate the law if they happen to be his friends, or if they're doing it for a good purpose, or if he thinks that it would be inconvenient, or if he might not be elected." Now, this is a terrible way for a Christian to speak to a man who's sitting there beside you, sweating large drops. It's as unethical as it can be. But it's not bad politics. It's not bad politics. Because one must not confuse these two things. There is a place where one says, we are no longer playing the game of God's love for one another, but rather we are now playing the game of establishing the rules under which we are to live. And this is a hard intellectual fact of life. This is now the place where we are testing and measuring and being as scientifically careful as we can be about the rules that we are about to establish. Because these rules are to be followed by coercion, by force. This is precisely the distinction which Weber makes here, and it is the point at which the Christian begins to feel his unique responsibility, and how responsible and how clear-thinking he really must be in political activity, because he's got something that almost nobody else has. And that is, one, a confidence or a belief that people are basically worth saving, wherever that's possible. And number two, a belief that law, government, ought not to invade another person's freedom, except to the extent that it is necessary to set up the most useful system that society can have, the greatest measure of utility. You ought not to move into another man just to make him squirm. And above all, you ought never to use your power for your own purposes. Power is an extremely dangerous thing, and politics is shot through with it. Politics is, after all, essentially an exercise of power followed by coercion, which is legitimized because it is political activity. Well, this, I thought, was one of the more interesting luncheons that I had at Brookings, and I think maybe that this turned out to be one of the more interesting speeches that the Chamber of Commerce had had in Brookings for a while, too. And I felt that this was really a pretty good demonstration of one who is speaking about faith active in one's daily life. What does that mean to you? Almost all of us have an opportunity along the line some way to become politically involved. It's another one of these things that you can't really ignore. I have another little saying from the law that I kind of like. We lawyers always beat ourselves regularly on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. I think we wear as many hair shirts as anybody else as a profession because we are, well, we're helped so much by you people. You constantly keep reminding us of our shortcomings. And so we examine ourselves rather frequently. And then we get a little bit defensive and we come up with sayings like this. If you leave your law to lawyers, you will soon have for law the lawyer's leavings. And this is very much true. Because what comes out of a legislature, what comes out of a legislative body, is meaningful only to the persons who use it. Law or rule, after all, is simply a tool that you are to use in your world. Now, if that happens to be in the banking business, the bank collection code is something that you know quite a bit about. If it happens to be in the kind of fertilizers that are produced for crops, and you are in that business, you know a lot about it. you then have something of very valuable content to contribute to the substantive knowledge and the precise information. How do you get it from your expertise over to the place where the legislature is going to do something with it? Now, I assure you that you're not going to get it by one telling each other about what a bunch of crooks the politicians are, or two saying that this is such a dirty process that I'm going to stay out of it entirely, or three, and I couldn't be more serious about this one, you're not going to get it by writing a postcard to the guy at the time that the legislative session is on and saying, you are making a terrible mistake, this is a terrible thing to do, speaking in grand generalities up here. He's not in the least bit interested in that. What you're going to do, if you're going to be effective politically, and perhaps at this point I should qualify myself as being at least a little bit of an expert here, because I happen to be just slightly above my eyebrows in politics in the state of Washington. What you're going to have to do is, first of all, get off the seat and learn something about what you're talking about. Now, if you start out in your own area, that's very helpful, because you already have some information about that. But before you go gunning at a legislator anywhere, you know your facts. You know, you study it. You think it through. You give it some serious attention. And point number two is, get yourself organized at least a year before the legislative session rolls around. At least a year before. Right now, in the state of Washington, the bills that are going to pass or not pass next year are being decided on. That show that's going to go on down there later is largely over, except for the trimmings, by the time the ball begins to roll. After all, there are going to be, in my state, something between 3,500 and 4,000 bills dropped into the hopper. And fortunately, only about 600 or 700 of them are ever going to get the governor's signature. And about 300 of those shouldn't. The rest of them are there because good old Senator Zilch from someplace or other has been accosted by one of you guys, and he's been told by you on the spur of the moment that you think there ought to be such and such a law enacted, and he'd like to have a vote from his hometown, so he goes up and he has a bill written up and he puts it in the hopper, and then he passes the word around, for heaven's sakes, fellas, don't pass this one. And I got to put it in here, see? And this is no good. That's why it goes from almost 4,000 bills down to about 500. Because most of the bills that go into a legislative session are only window dressing. They're there to give you something to think about, what a good guy Joe is. He went in there and he pitched for me, all right. Too bad that nobody would help him out. Joe never had any intention of helping you out. Joe was there thinking only in terms of what he was going to do himself. Now, why doesn't Joe want to help you out in those circumstances? It's either for the reason that your bill is no good, and it really isn't, you see, that you simply haven't thought it through, that you don't have a sound program to stand on, or it's on the basis that Joe has run up against such obvious gunfire that he's going to get mowed down in the process, and there is nothing that you are doing to help him face the battle. A politician lives in a life that's kind of like a jungle, where he's got to survive. And if he's going to survive, you're going to have to get behind him. And I don't mean now in terms of just the $5 that are going to help him get elected. But you've got to be making the right kind of noises, the right kind of time, the right kind of people, so that when Joe runs into trouble, you and the rest of the people in your ward, your block, have already told him how things are going to go. It is amazing how much more effective your letter this month to your legislator will be than when you get down there next year and write him all of those pre-printed, mimeographed postcards that you don't even know what they are usually. You just put your name on the bottom of them, or maybe you people don't even do that, I don't know. But if you would drop a card right now to your legislator about one of the bills that are being considered, and you ought to know what they are, see? And I know that that's not easy, because you aren't reading the newspapers and you aren't talking to them and you aren't giving them a chance to come around and speak to the Lions Club now. You want him to speak next spring when he's in the legislative session. He's got more sex appeal then. But if you get to him now, you see, right now he's trying to educate himself. Which way is the wind blowing? How do those things stand? Where is the community? What do you really want? At this point, you've got a tremendous opportunity to use him. Well, that brings me around to the question where we came in, and as far as I'm concerned, we can knock it off. And that's this. If you do tell Joe now what you think ought to be done, and you give him a reasonable argument, what's he going to do with it? Is he going to go down there and sell you out? Well, first of all, you've elected him to use his judgment, and he's apt to do just exactly that. This is not a sell-out in the sense that you might think of it. It's not quite that bald. Think of the realities of the legislative situation that you ought to know about. Imagine for just one moment that you are a legislator and that you've been assigned to the Committee on Highways and that there are 11 of you and there have been assigned to your committee 300 bills to look at, to report out one time or another. How do you suppose that bills get selected for reporting out from a committee? Well, there are 11 of you. Each guy's got an interest in something. There are 300 bills. What order will they be taken? In the order that they're assigned to you? Oh, come on, you know better than that. That's nonsense. Each one of the 11 members of the legislature is going to get to take a bill and say, this is my turn now. This is the bill that I want considered. And then the next guy, and then the next guy, and then the next guy, and so you go around and come back to the first man, and he gets to take the next bill and put it on the table. Now, when you go to him and say, Joe, I've got this pet bill of mine, and I'd sure like to have you get it out of committee and put it on the floor, and he says, you have any idea what the chances of that bill being passed are? And he says, well, I don't suppose that they're good, but let's get in there and give it the good old college try, Joe. And Joe says, look, I got 68 people over here who are asking me to get after Bill 202. That bill's got a reasonable chance. It's a good piece of legislation and it ought to get out. You want me to shoot my vote on your bill, which hasn't any realistic chance of being enacted, and thereby throw away the only opportunity that I'm going to have to get 202 out of here. Now, if you want me to spend that much muscle, that many of my green stamps on your bill, brother, you've got to do more than just come in here and say that this is a personal favor. This is not sane. Now, this is but one of many illustrations that you ought to be learning from your legislator. This guy is not dishonest. This guy is simply a person who is trying to do something in a rational, orderly, sensible way of handling it. How do you know how you ought to proceed in Minnesota or North Dakota or New York or wherever you are from? You'd be surprised how many people would be delighted to come and tell you about this. There's nothing that a politician likes to do more than to appear in his precinct and make speeches. And there's no subject that he can talk about with greater facility than how things are down at the legislature. And once you get in there and suffer through the 15 minutes of how he staved off the Third World War last time, then you get the question and answer period. And there's nothing wrong about forgetting about the Third World War and asking him the question of, well, now, Senator, in our legislature, how is a bill selected for action? How is one most effectively filed? How does the legislature run from that? How is the voting done? How can we best communicate with you? When is the critical time? How can you best get the information back? That is your responsibility in this game. One other comment. Politicians talk to lobbyists. All politicians talk to lobbyists. Lobbyists are so much more valuable than all of you people sitting in this room that you just have no... You're out of it, as my kids would say. For the very simple reason that a lobbyist, like Time Magazine, shows his bias all the way. It's never any doubt which way they're slanted. And he doesn't even pretend to be neutral. But boy, is he informed. If you really want to know what's happening to the fish in eastern Washington, go talk to the lobbyist for the Sportsmen's Association. He has the information. And if this lobbyist is any good, he is totally reliable. Now, he's totally biased, but he's totally reliable because he knows that the first time he slips me some bad information, and he will never get another bill passed with no dam so that a fish can swim up there. He's got to be reliable, and he's got to be trustworthy, and this is something that you people have got to learn, too, if you want to play the political game. Never, never feed a politician a bad line. He must rely on his sources of information because he's got 4,000 bills to look at. And if you feed him a phony, if you feed him a bad line, you've frittered away some very valuable time, and what's worse, you may have made him look like a thoroughgoing jackass on the floor when he came up with the statistics that there are 627 people living on saltwater flats, and there haven't been more than 25 there in the last 60 years. Because somebody's going to nail him, you see, because the politicians, lobbyists for the other side is going to be in with reliable statistics, and you are through forever. It is for this reason, basically, that lobbyists are a very, very effective source of information and influence in a political body, and they ought to be. Politics is a very ethical business, ethical in the sense of legal. It is a very ethical business in the sense that it carries its sanctions much more directly and quickly than almost anywhere else in our life. A politician who gets out of line, who violates the legal kind of ethics, is disciplined by the rest of his comrades just like this. We have in Romans 13 some reference to the man who does not bear the sword in vain. Transfer it to a whip. That whip is not born in vain in a legislative session. The party whip, the guy who's there, disciplines these people ethically, you say. There is a very distinct kind of ethics in politics, and there is a great admiration for honesty and reliability of information. In short, these guys are not crooks. They are men who happen to be perhaps a little bit more concerned than you are about politics generally. Most of them are very well motivated people and really surprisingly honest. But they must work inside of those schemes and techniques and systems that I've been trying to describe for you now. And that is why they cannot act out of pure sentiment. But they must act on some pretty hard data. That doesn't make a very exciting story. But nonetheless, I hope that it is at least helpful in thinking about some of the ways that you could approach. Suppose that I now subject myself to 5 minutes of cross-examination here, and then if any of you want to get down in the gutter and argue about politics on a more mundane level, we'll shift over to the adjoining building and slug it out there. Yeah.
This top of page 51, I see a kind of a bomb here for religions. Paper is saying Protestantism, especially legitimated the authoritarian state.
Yeah.
Luther relieved the individual of the ethical responsibility for war and transferred it to the authorities. To obey the authorities in matters other than those of faith could never constitute guilt. Don't you suppose that Hitler read this?
Sure. No question. I mean, there's no question. I don't know whether he read this, but I would suspect that he may very well have. And you see, this is Weber all the way down the line.
But, is this true? What he quotes?
No. Well, that depends how you read Luther. Now we've got a big argument coming up. But certainly, a great many people in the Lutheran Church have taken that just exactly literally. That, after all, our religion is essentially a matter of rules and obedience. And when the ruler says to you, this is the rule, do what you're told, people have felt that, well, this then is absolution from any responsibility on my part. Witness the whole Nuremberg trial picture, you see.
politics, and actually it's difficult for a Christian to be a politician.
Probably not as difficult as it is to be an honest grocer, because honest grocers can get away with a lot more dirt than a politician can. He's got a fatter thumb on the scale and a slipperier knife on the head of lettuce, and nobody is watching him. When you're in the legislative body and the guys across the line are hot for your throat, they are really waiting for you to slip. And the first step that you've got that's out of line, there's a price on your head. Now, it's true that there is gentlemanly conduct in the legislative bodies, and it isn't fair to be impolite, and you always say the gentleman from Wenatchee, while you are carefully separating his head from the rest of his anatomy. The point is that these people are all knowledgeable about the same thing and in very direct contact and watching each other with a real scrutiny during this period. Politicians might like to be dishonest, but they have a way of keeping each other honest, at least during the time they're in direct session. I know that there's an awful lot of graft, Vic. It's a lot of graft, I know, in public life. The spoiled system is in itself frequently thought of as being a kind of a graft. And I know that there are people who have been in politics for a short time and then have retired to a life of affluence. We know these people, of course. But I don't think that this is any more of a temptation to the Christian there than it would be working in an institution in which he is under less direct surveillance. In short, I think that, quote, Christians, close quote, walk away with more dollars worth of Boeing's property because Boeing's guard system is not as good as, than they do walk away with tax money because the tax fund is more zealously guarded. That's the way I feel about it. Yes. The politician here will work with all the skill, the hatchet man that you see, well, for example, in the medical profession, where when the doctors decide that Dr. Smith has got to go, I don't know of anybody who's a better hatchet man than this association. They can come up with more dirt on a guy that they've been scientifically collecting and whamming better than anybody else I know. Politicians will do this too. Now, does a political body have it in for a Christian who is in politics because he is a Christian for that reason alone? No. The last session of the legislature, I was interested in one bill that dealt with children in institutions. And the House leader, the floor leader in the House, refused to put the bill on the floor. I wanted to know why. And he said because he hadn't talked to the Archbishop yet. He wanted to know what the Archbishop would say about the bill, because the bishop has a lot of institutions which would be affected by that bill. That's legitimate, isn't it? And so I went out and had a call put through to the bishop, and he said that it was all right, we could pass the bill. Back and told the floor leader, and he said he didn't believe me. I thought that was very wise of him. Because once that bill got through on that vote, he'd have to convince the governor that I had double-crossed him, if I had. And he wouldn't be about able to sell the governor on that one because he wasn't on the same side. And so he said he wanted to talk to the bishop and get the bishop on the phone where he could talk to him. So we did that, and he talked to the bishop, and then we went out and passed it. Now, this man is being very responsive to a pressure and to a group which represents a religious body. That group is able to express itself as effectively on the floor of a legislative body, and they have as much right to as does Safeway or South Seattle Lions Club. They are a group which has needs that must be met and served by the political organization of the state. They ought to be heard, and this one particular group, which shall be nameless if you haven't guessed, just happens to be very well organized and very articulate, and they do a dandy job. Too bad that we can't do that. It's too bad that you are automatically alienated from the love of God in the Lutheran Church when you attend a block meeting. It's too bad that we can't have a man who is a Lutheran who can also be ethical and also be a practical politician. But it seems to be very hard for our membership to accept this idea. And the reason that they can't accept it is, of course, primarily the kind of reasoning which we've just been looking at in Faber's book. Yes, ma'am.
Do you think should the church put money into lobbying?
I think it would be a splendid idea. The Lutheran Church had a man who was available at every legislative session there to inform the legislators about how we felt, or how people in the church felt, or how the people in the church divided neatly on this one, or to alert them to any specific problems and needs of the Lutheran Welfare Association or whatever it may be. And we needn't feel that this man would disgrace us. The system will take care of him if he's not honest. And I think it would be a very fine thing. Yes?
Aren't we pluralistic enough, though, as a church, that it'd be pretty hard to get a, quote, Lutheran position on most of the issues apart from our institutions now?
I agree with you. And when our lobbyist goes down and the legislator says to him, how does the Lutheran Church stand on this? And he says, well, we've got 1,000 people in this area and we stand 500 to 500. He now has the facts that he needs to know. Sir? Pardon? Yes, we do have. Sir?
Going back to the quotations of Luther, why is it that the quotation made to you by those who associated with German policy, Luther's reference there is to the power of the state in which we're all part. And theoretically, there isn't much difference between that situation and one where the individual American citizen claim that his guilt in Vietnam is not his, but
it's not. I agree with you. No, I quite agree with you that one must decide for himself in the last analysis where the point is where the state can appropriately say to you, this is a matter of good order. This you must do. And even though I disagree with this, still I must do it. Now, this is a compromise. This is a compromise that I have to make in order to be a political animal. Compromise, if you are thinking it's a bad thing, I've got news for you. Compromise is a lovely thing in our life, at least as I see it. Because if I never compromise with anybody, then I really am Max Weber's absolutist, who insists always upon measuring questions of logic in terms of absolutes. On the other hand, there comes the question where a person must ask himself, finally and ultimately, has this gone beyond what I can accept as an individual? Have I now reached the point where it's beyond what the state can do? That's a very, very difficult question. It's one that you've got to decide for yourself, because in the last analysis, that's your responsibility and mine. But in Luther's concept of the state as being a good gift of God, to maintain law and order in society, great. Doesn't make it any easier for a person. And you get some terribly difficult questions in a practical political environment. May I illustrate for just a moment with this sort of thing? Back in my own bailiwick of law, the Supreme Court of the United States has always been an organism which has been freer to move, perhaps, less encumbered in many ways than the legislative bodies. That's because there are fewer and they've got different kinds of power. Today we see the Supreme Court of the United States under more vigorous attack than we have for a long, long time. This is because in an era of very rapidly changing forms in our society, the Supreme Court has, wisely or unwisely, I don't know, but I think honestly, decided to take on more new questions more rapidly than almost any other court has in a long time. Every court comes into being with a certain amount of goodwill. It is one of the odd things in life that you people don't really trust lawyers, but you think judges are just about the finest thing that there are. And a judge is nothing except an incompetent lawyer who couldn't make a living practicing, so he got elected to the bench. Nonetheless, this aura of respectability and propriety and almost sanctity that is built into the concept of the judge serves a tremendously valuable function in our society, because judges can tell us to do things which are really pretty preposterous at times, and we think that because he sits on a hair sack and wears a black robe that it must be right. Well, in part, there's an awful lot of drama of a quasi-religious nature that goes into this. And it is one reason why politicians and the church as politician have been quite willing to snow you with the idea that law is holy, sacred, immutable, not to be violated. When the judge speaks, the heavens thunder, and this is really not the judge, this is God speaking. Fasten your seat belts. We're now going to do so-and-so. I do not mean to be sacrilegious, but will you observe the Ten Commandments once more, you say? Had Moses simply gone into the tents, written them out in 30 days, and come back and announced that this was best for Israel, he would have had a tough time. But with quaking mountains and smoking mountains and tremendous drama and a shining face and the voice of God, the people took it without any doubt. And it had that tremendous significance as law in molding Israel. Incidentally, someday when we've got more time on another occasion, I want to talk about that. Legal structures and systems take centuries to come into existence. Centuries to come into existence. And here come a bunch of stupid slaves waddling out of Egypt without brain one. And a few years later, they have such a magnificent legal system that has no parallel anywhere in the world, and is yet the basis of the revised Code of Washington, and I've often wondered how it happened. Sometimes I almost believe in miracles. But that's beside the point at the moment. The point that I want to make right now is this, that the court has to use this quasi-religious, this quasi-holy thou shalt nots, you see, in order to be effective. Now, you can rub that just so far before the guilt comes off. And no court ought to push its luck too far, or else somebody pretty soon will start saying, you know, that's really not a god up there in that black robe. That's just old Chief Justice. You can name your own. You see what's happening? This happened to us once in the United States in a most dramatic political experience that I think we've ever had. It was after the Dred Scott cases, in which our country was torn by serious political problems, where we had not been good enough legal artists or political scientists to work out a suitable arrangement. And the President of the United States, who was a more or less adequate lawyer before he went wrong, a man by the name of Abraham Lincoln, threw into prison an officer of the army without proper reason. Subject yourself to risks of injury, risks of being robbed, risks of being mugged, risks of being violated in almost every way by these people. I'm not saying that you must accept it without trying to do something about it, but you must be willing to expose yourselves to greater risks than you have before. And why? Well, that's all sorts of problems. The first of all sorts of reasons. The first one of them for me is
start out on the most elementary basis. It's the only thing that will work. That's my first analysis of it. And that's purely a pragmatist or a law point of view. It is the only thing that will work ultimately. Beyond that, I could go on and say that I also think that it is spiritually right to be willing to share with this man his burden. One more comment about that, because I do happen to feel very, very strongly about it. For those of you who have never seen a Negro slum, for those of you who have never been where these people live in the large cities like New York, you must inform yourself before you make your judgments. Do you know that those poor souls live under such circumstances that if you live that way, if we lived next to each other in the same way, every man, woman, and child in the United States would live in less than two boroughs in New York? That's the condition. And the circumstances under which you live in those conditions are not such that you can ask for a measured, calm response. Sir?
What does the lawyer, and possibly the lawyer politician or the lay politician, if I can use that term, do in respect to the church people, lay as well as clergy, who support the right of dissent, which seems to be anti-Lutheran for many of our people? Now, we must love this person, and we may even support them politically, and agree with them morally. But the average layman, the average Lutheran politician, of which there are many politicians have to be Lutheran, you need it from
yes.
Normally say, just the pastor ought to shut up on it. He had no right to say this way. Now, I've spent plenty of time trying to support dissent from my pulpit and elsewhere. And before you get swatted down like this by all the lawyers that are coming together, I only have a few, but I have enough of them to swat me down. Every lawyer says, you can't possibly encourage dissent. You've got to be a good Lutheran. Plus, also, what you just said, you've got to uphold law and order.
Yeah.
Where is the right to dissent in the Lutheran Church?
Every man who is involved as a functionary in a political body, including the corporate church, because it is a political body, has some responsibilities for making his organization viable, making it live. And he must measure in the same pragmatic terms as I do in the law school, or as a politician does in the state of Washington. What the breaking points of anarchy are in his body, and where it ceases, where you reach the point of diminishing returns in effectiveness. That is the kind of dirty log-rolling politics that you've got to play with your congregation. This means, in short, that when he speaks of his congregation as a political organism, as a group, that he has to use precisely the same political science skills that a man does in General Motors. Now, I cannot tell you in terms of line and verse where that point is reached. You're a pretty good politician. You've got to figure it out. This is a mixture of the ability to know what you want to do and smart enough to figure out how you're going to do it and know when you've done enough. You are the Supreme Court at this point. It would really like to get into that next big problem, but it's going to turn down the petition for certiorari anyway, because you just can't do it till you get the hounds off your back and get the billboards down.
What do you think about the civil rights law preventing people to vote for the court to vote for the candidate rights?
I think that it is not at all impossible to take a man by the hand and take him to the polls and read to him a ballot and say, this is who is running, these are the parties, now you are permitted to cast a vote. I think if the man has enough intelligence to be out of an institution and is given that much information, that he probably is voting more intelligently than 50% of the people who vote by position, whether it's higher or lower on the ballot, or whether the name starts with L or G or X.
But don't you believe that the man takes him into the polling place and starts about
that somewhere? Yes, sir, I do. And I believe that this is the responsibility of every man in the community to be offering to do that. I think that I ought to be going around to everybody I meet and say, how would you like to know who the best candidate is running for this office? And if you would like to have me take you down to the polling place and point out the squares to you, this is good political action. And I think it ought to be done. And if I am politically foolish enough to let you steal a march on me by taking him down there fairly now, I mean fairly, there's no fair buying it, that's different. But if I'm foolish enough to let you steal the march on me this way, good for you.
I don't think that would be a foolish thing.
Oh, education in terms of politics is...
Yeah,
that's right. You've got to stay outside the curtain. But you can get it pretty well memorized for him before he gets in. And that's good political action. I spend an awful lot of time with legislators telling them which way to mark when the bill comes out on the floor.
No.
The last analysis, he's got to cast his own vote. One more and then let's break for those people who would like to get home. And if we, yeah.
If you're a politician and you're in office, it's very desirable to stay in that. If you could stay in office for four more years and have your successor do you feel that in Washington today it might be possible that there's a lot of expedient action being taken to stay in office whereby the country's future is being mortgaged?
Being mortgaged?
Right. In other words, we will. The men making decisions today, if you feel that it's possible, the men making decisions today feel they are mortgaging our future.
I have a feeling that the way you're using the word mortgaged now gives it an evil connotation. Is that what you mean?
I'm
trying to see whether or not every time a politician acts, he commits his country or his constituency to certain activities and skews what they're going to be doing in the future, thus encumbering them and removing some of their choice. He directs them. If I can say it positively, you see, every time a politician acts, he slants what the country is going to be doing. Now, if that's what you mean by putting a mortgage on the country, thereby compelling it to do certain things. Any politician who doesn't do this is not doing his duty. That's what he's supposed to do. If, on the other hand, you mean that I want to stay in office so much that although I know this will be destructive of good products, I won't get to the goal this way, and it's really destructive, and I'm doing it for my personal gain, this is an obvious abuse of my position. Now, question, do I think that that kind of activity is going on? Yes, sir, I do. I think that it's going on in roughly the same equation, the same quantity that it's going on in General Motors, American Lutheran Church, other kinds of organizations, which are policed with about the same vigor. Not more and not less. Because a man who is dean of the law school at the University of Washington, or who is chairman of the board at Zilch Tractor Company, feels exactly the same desire to manipulate things for his personal advantage. No more and no less. Power feelings, the desire for power, are accentuated perhaps somewhat by having more of it. But we have rather carefully seen to it that the more opportunity
generally speaking, that a man has to sell the country out for the advantage of himself or his wife or his family, the more carefully we watch him. And I don't really believe that the absolute volume of corruption in Washington, D.C., let alone Washington State, is any greater than it would be in a comparable organization. But it happens. Sure it happens. Now, let's call it quits for here, and if any of you want to fight, let's go over to Koinonia and we'll fight there for a while.